Okay, we're back on tape. Well, the, you know, one of the questions is, for example, you know, if Solera finishes the genome first, which they probably will, do they have a responsibility to share that information with people like you, for example, who don't have a profit motive involved? And I don't, you know.
Well, I'm sure that they probably will. But, of course, they will hold certain patent rights probably to all the information that they're releasing. Because by themselves, if there were no other investigators, they really couldn't do anything with that information. They do not have the manpower, nor necessarily the ideas to be able to go and attack every gene there is within the database.
Sure.
So they are dependent upon other, I mean, the general community, the scientific, general scientific community, to be able to ultimately make money for them. Now, what the percentage in terms of, you know, what percent rights they want in the end, you know, is probably going to be a huge issue of discussion. But this is not without precedent. I mean, there are companies, for example, there's a company that has made utilized random insertion to make knockouts. And depending how much you're willing to pay, you can get those knockout mice at different prices. So that, for I don't remember exactly what the numbers are, but for example, if you're willing to give up 90% of the rights of the mouse, then that mouse only costs you $10,000. If you want to keep 90% of the patent rights and the company remains 10%, it may cost you $50,000 for the same mouse. So it always comes down to, obviously, what the costs of the reagents are. Which is, I think, a reality. It's unfortunate, but it's a reality of the market.
And do you hold any patents, or have pending
patents? We hold one patent based on the identification and discovery of the blink gene and the protein. It was an interesting learning experience just to go through the entire patenting process. It's probably not a process that I would want to undergo again. And I don't know what the, you know, the clinical, the implications of having a patent on that particular protein is at this point. I mean, for probably 99.9% of all patents filed probably are going to be meaningless. In that, not that they're not important discoveries, but in terms of clinical applicability and there are probably going to be no products ever made from those particular things. But nonetheless, the technology transfer office and obviously the companies basically try to patent everything that comes out.
Usually when you're on a faculty, you have to, it really belongs to the university.
I mean, basically the university owns X percent of the patent. But it was an interesting experience. Just going through it. I mean, the technical aspects of what one has to go through in terms of filing a patent is just in many ways painful. One can think of a lot better use of one's time, scientifically.
Okay. Well, let's... We got sidetracked off the business of teaching, so we're actually almost done with that. But I had one more question about it, and that is, we talked about how students had changed in terms of attitudes, but what's the sort of gender and ethnic makeup of the students here at WashU?
Well, it's very program dependent. I actually don't know the specific percentage of the breakdowns, but for example, some of the fields such as structural biology, biophysics, tend to be more male-dominant than female-dominant. Many of the engineering subspecialties, obviously, tend to be more male-dominant than female-predominant. But in actuality, I think that the majority of the other programs, such as neurosciences, immunology, a molecular and cellular biology, at least at the graduate student level, mm-hmm. there is an equal representation, if not a greater representation, by women over men. Mm-hmm. Now that, you know, is an interesting discussion as to why that percentage hasn't, is not equally represented at the higher levels of academics, okay? But at least at the graduate student level at WashU, and I know for many other universities, it is equal, if not greater, representation mm-hmm. of women over men. In terms of racial representation, it's pretty evenly distributed in terms of its distribution of Caucasian and Asians, at least within the university. I mean, clearly there's certain minority groups, such as blacks, which continue to be totally underrepresented amongst the graduate school programs. I think basically in all subspecialties across the board.
Even in medical school?
No, not medical school. So okay. I'm classifying medical school right. now as a professional school rather
okay.
than graduate school.
Okay.
In medical school, I don't know, again, I don't know what the percentages are, but I think this year I vaguely remember the women also outnumber men, and the racial makeup there, Asians, again, usually are overrepresented. Other minority groups, such as African Americans, are better represented amongst the medical school mm-hmm. than, for example, the graduate school. Mm-hmm. That's the makeup of our graduate program. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in certain programs, Asian is probably even more overrepresented depending on what the geography is. Mm-hmm. So certain California schools, there's clearly even a greater overrepresentation there.
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead to that other question, which is why aren't the women mm-hmm. represented at the higher level? Well, first of all, what does the faculty look like mm-hmm. here in terms of gender?
The faculty here, I can't tell you the exact numbers. I would not be surprised if it's something on the order of probably 85% male and 15% female. And that may be an overrepresentation of the female faculty. Now, it also depends on which faculty you're talking mm-hmm. about. Okay. So those percentages, I'm only considering people that are in basic sciences.
Okay.
If one were to take the full faculty, I think there the percentage of women probably will be higher because I'm including a variety of clinicians, full-time mm-hmm. clinicians. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the basic science faculty of people running full-time labs, I would probably guess it's going to be 15% women, and that may be overrepresentation of the actual numbers. Mm-hmm. So this is a huge issue as to why women are not better represented at the higher level, you know, at the professorial level or associate professor levels. And without a doubt, it's multifactorial, some of things of which we just can't change. You know, one factor, obviously, is the issue of family. The scientific environment is not conducive with somebody taking 9 months off or 3 months off, especially, you know, during the early years when you are doing the work. I know of no competitor of mine that would say, oh, you know, my competitor is on leave, therefore really to even the competition field, I'm not going to do any science for the next 3 months. That just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one factor. Mm-hmm. I think by and large, this university is by and large very supportive of the faculty, mm-hmm. of the women faculty. I know of very few examples. So in terms of people that have come in, and in terms of the success or failure rate, in terms of obtaining tenure and things like that, my guess is that based on the very small number of individuals that I've known, that the percent of women and the percent of men that fail probably are comparable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Percent based on the number
Right.
In the bigger
number
picture.
Number of assistant professors that are hired at WashU.
But if it's a percent of the number, then the women have a higher failure rate because there are fewer of them hired.
No. So, right. So I'm saying that if, out of the 15 women
right.
assistant professors versus the 85 men right. as assistant professors, the percent failure rate is probably comparable between those two groups.
Okay.
There's a difference clearly in the absolute numbers
right.
that go on.
Okay.
So I was discussing this with one of my friends about 6 months ago. I think one of the major differences, which needs to be actively worked on, is the perception that women cannot succeed in academic science. So again, as I told you before, there's greater than 50% of our graduate classes are female. Less than 50%, but still a substantial percentage of our postdocs are women. And yet, when it comes to post-hiring, there's, I think, the greatest discrepancy.
Mm-hmm.
So one, it's clearly an issue with the search committees.
Mm-hmm.
And two, when I've talked to some search committees, they just said, they have expressed that we just don't get that many female applications, applications from women. And the question is, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And when I ask a variety of the trainees, postdoctoral fellows, or senior students, I have a perception, they have expressed certain perceptions. They don't think that they can do it. They don't think that they're quite up to the task. Okay? So I think this is an interesting perception. It's not that they're going to fail, because clearly the people that have done it succeed just as well as their male colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the perception that they won't succeed, and hence they don't apply.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one possible hypothesis to test. I have no data to necessarily mm-hmm. support it one way or the other.
Do they think that they won't succeed at doing the science, or they won't succeed at getting the job?
They don't think that they will be able to succeed in combining family,
okay.
doing the science, and being tenured.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily one aspect, it's just
all of
the entire overwhelming aspect.
Right.
I was actually at a retreat where we had a faculty panel discussing
mm-hmm.
husband, wife, dual career
mm-hmm.
type of things, and one
mm-hmm.
of the women there expressed that her perception was that the men were just smarter and they
okay.
were going to succeed. And which totally shocked me.
Yeah.
Okay, so I related to them as what is the basis of your statement? And just look at these classmates. But then at the same time, they don't realize there are equal number of women classmates that they have
mm-hmm.
that are equally qualified.
Mm-hmm.
They probably just don't toot their horn as much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that becomes an important issue. And the
mm-hmm.
only way I can think of trying to at least partly remedy that, I think, is basically we need more role models
mm-hmm.
of women academicians and women physician scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to be able to mentor the women physician
mm-hmm.
scientists as well as the men,
mm-hmm.
but the women in particular to impress upon them that if they just continue doing good work, in the long run, everything will work out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes. We understand the need for family. We understand, the time constraints that one
mm-hmm.
puts on them. But they have to take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think human nature comes in, as to people don't want to take the risk on things that they think they may fail in. Because
mm-hmm.
it's without a doubt, it's going to require hard work.
Mm-hmm.
For them to undertake, accept that risk and to take that type of career choice means that they're going to basically put away probably 6 to 8 years of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time,
mm-hmm.
especially already post-training,
mm-hmm.
At a time when your parents are still asking you, why are you still in school? Didn't we pay already for your college career,
mm-hmm.
8 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is mm-hmm. still a perception thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the women clearly are well qualified and they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's partly a mental thing of, I think, getting certain one is certain students to overcome that particular hurdle.
Now, some of the universities give you more time to tenure if you're having children in this process.
Yeah.
Does this place do that?
I think they take it in consideration. Okay, but you know, one of the things that determines tenure is national and international perception, okay, as in reputation. And of course, the international reputation or national reputation is based on your productivity per year. Okay, people read your papers and they go, oh, so-and-so is again doing good work. And if you fall off the face of the earth in terms of productivity for 9 months or, you know, whatever amount of time, it clearly affects it. You know, nobody's going to say, well, the national reputation needs to be corrected for X. So I think that becomes a difficult part. Because, you know, especially, I think this is most important, especially the early part of the career, where, yeah, the university may well do that, but one's reputation scientifically clearly will be affected one way or the other. And I don't see an easy solution
well,
to that problem.
I know, because I saw pictures in your office of your two cute little kids. So obviously your wife, Mary, who's in academics, had to deal with this issue. I think you said, you told me your children are seven now, so she must have been in the early part of her career when she had twins, which is a lot of kids to take care of all at once.
And I think, no, absolutely. I think, you know, it's a huge responsibility. It's a huge amount of effort and a huge amount of time. And I think she has done a phenomenal job, you know, in trying to, in balancing all those things. But at the same time, not taking anything away from her, she's not a laboratory-based individual. Okay? So many of her tenure decisions is based on the amount of clinical work that she does. And that's easier to measure, I think. It take when one takes in contact of children and leave and things like that than it is productivity in terms of papers. Because people don't quite see that kind of relationship when one evaluates a scientific career. You know, you don't see the you know, when somebody goes and gives a distinguished talk, right? You know, visiting professor. You know, there are lots of women, distinguished women professors have given talks, and to this day, I've yet to hear that, you know, when the person introduces them, that they are also the mother of, blah blah blah. So while I value it, you know, just from an individual and person type of view, it is very hard to integrate that into evaluating the scientific productivity of a person. And I think that is just a difference in the two cultures. And again, I don't see how one is going to be able to resolve those kinds of paradoxes between the two types of, because we're really talking with two different types of language.
I actually usually get to this question a little later, but it's a natural progression here. So you are in that field where you have to have your productivity measured by numbers of papers and whatnot. And having children affects men, too. Not in the same way, but it does. So how has that impacted your career? We'll get to how it impacts your personal life eventually.
I think, I mean, there are clearly certain things that you would rather do because of the time issue. On the whole, I think it's positive. I'll just give you that first, okay? So obviously, you know, once one has a family, there are certain constraints in terms of the hours that one can spend in the laboratory. you know, as a graduate student, it wouldn't bother me to spend 80 to 100 hours in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. That's the way you can function. Mm-hmm. Once you have a family, obviously, that entire equation changes. Mm-hmm. So here, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to have a very understanding wife, and we have a great nanny. Mm-hmm. And we have, by and large, very, very healthy kids. So one sort of divvies the time mentally as to what one can do. And hence, I still, you know, during the regular week, I spend most of my time in the laboratory. Usually I won't get home until between 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the evening. So at most, I probably have 2 hours with my kids, at most. Actually, now that they're 7, they really don't care about me anyway, and they just want to go out and do their own thing, which I'm sure will only continue in this vein as they get older. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the number of hours I have with them during the evening is actually extremely limited. You know, we may read together, we may play one or two games together, you know, and that's about it. One thing I do differently is that whereas before the kids, actually I would spend a lot of time over the weekends in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. And what I do now is that at most I will spend Saturday mornings in the laboratory at most. And then basically all Saturday afternoon, all day Sunday, I spend at home with them. Mm-hmm. I take my work with me to home. Sometimes I can get to it, but usually out of procrastination, I don't. But I think that's one way I try to balance mm-hmm. between the two. It's not ideal. Mm-hmm. You would like, obviously, to spend more time with the kids, but then other things would suffer, and then if you spend more time with one, and then that takes away from the other. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to sort of figure out a happy medium for yourself mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to try to balance the two. Mm-hmm. There's no strict equation. It's not necessarily just a number of hours. It's actually what you do with, you know, do with mm-hmm. them, that I think that's extremely important.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Since we talked about women on faculty, let's go ahead and talk about the faculty again from the ethnic point of view. Mm-hmm. Does the faculty, other than women, which we know are mm-hmm. underrepresented on mm-hmm. the faculty, how does it look ethnically compared to the graduate students?
Compared to the graduate students, is probably very similar in that, again, African Americans are underrepresented. Asian Americans are typically overrepresented.
Asian Americans or Asians?
Asians.
Asians, okay.
Asians as well as Asian Americans okay. are overrepresented. Even in St. Louis.
Even in St. Louis, okay.
That's, you know, the over-representation becomes even worse when you go to a place mm-hmm. on the West Coast or the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a reflection mm-hmm. of the makeup of what you see in the graduate student mm-hmm. class, mm-hmm. aside from the gender issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one of the things that I haven't heard too much about it lately, but I know that I read something in Science 6 or 8 months ago. It was an editorial about whether having so many foreign students was mm-hmm. good or bad mm-hmm. for American science. Mm-hmm. And most labs, there are many foreign students, I think mostly
well,
from
probably
Asia.
Foreign postdocs.
Yeah.
It's probably more postdoctoral mm-hmm. trainees rather than predoctoral trainees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So our pre-doctoral trainees are still pretty much, U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. It's the post-doctoral trainees that clearly are overrepresented in terms of non-U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's a reflection of the present-day graduate students, the things that present-day graduate students are worried about. And if you take a look, at Science, Nature, Cell, etc., in terms of the premier journals, you take a look at who the authors are. I will be willing to bet the overwhelming majority, or not overwhelming, a significant percentage will be, in terms of first author papers, would not be U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, that, I think, is just the nature of that particular position, in that it is not easy to find individuals who have finished graduate school training here that want to go on to do postdoctoral work, mm-hmm. who want to take those 3 to 5 years to do postdoctoral work and work at a certain level, mm-hmm. okay, of efficiency, creativity, you know, of that stature. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all, again, this is something I learned during, you know, the beginning part of my being a PI, which was, you know, I was trained in, was very fortunate to be trained in an outstanding environment, mm-hmm. and I just thought, you assemble that kind of team, and boom, off you go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you always see these huge laboratories, these outstanding laboratories like, you know, David Baltimore, where basically he creates an a particular type of environment, mm-hmm. and the people basically are totally independent, and they do their work, and they have these phenomenal observations. But I think in reality, probably 99.9% of the laboratory in the United States don't function that way. The overwhelming majority, over 90% of the laboratories, probably function based on the PI's own ideas, the PI's insights, and basically just directing people, mm-hmm. of what experiments to do. Mm-hmm. Very few labs, you know, it may be once in the blue moon that you have a postdoc who comes in, has some phenomenal idea, takes it upon himself or herself to do those experiments, have it all laid out beautifully, mm-hmm. and be able to carry on a certain type of conversation, mm-hmm. of a certain intellectual level with them. That is a very hard thing to find in most normal laboratories, mm-hmm. with the exception of those, you know, handful of very, very special laboratories. So basically what it comes down to then is that you need people that are willing to work hard. You need people that are willing to think. You need people that are willing to troubleshoot. And hopefully by that 3 to 4 year period of osmotic learning, that they will hopefully become independent. Now, that was really one of the shocking things for me when I became a PI. Because then, again, when I was a postdoc, every one of the individuals from our laboratory became an independent investigator. Okay? I mean, Art had a batting rate of about, you know, over 90% in terms of generation of independent scientists. Mm-hmm. And in reality, it's probably less than 10% in terms of churning out individuals who have the intellect, the drive, mm-hmm. And the patience, mm-hmm. to make it. Mm-hmm. I've seen many individuals, many of whom are in my lab, that have one of the three, mm-hmm. or maybe two out of the three. And it's hard to predict what people will do. Mm-hmm. But it's very rare to find a combination of all three. Mm-hmm. And it was pointed out to me that, you know, even in an outstanding program, graduate program like WashU's or Harvard's or Stanford's, odds are of the entering class in any graduate level, in any graduate program, is probably only 15% or 20% of those students that will become independent, that will clearly become independent investigators at an academic institution, or one of the leaders in the field in a biotechnology or pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. The others really are not going to become that independent. Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the quality of the students, or because of the availability of positions? Because I know most search mm-hmm. committees, you know, they'll get 300-400 applications for every job.
Yeah, and usually after about 2 hours, they can throw away about 80% of the applications.
Oh, okay.
Because the quality of the people just aren't there.
I see.
Even in the most difficult times, mm-hmm. there have always been positions open.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, institutions were not willing to take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
If they saw an individual that had outstanding credentials, came mm-hmm. from an outstanding lab, there was no hesitation ever mm-hmm. to hire them.
Mm-hmm.
But when funding levels dropped to single digits,
mm-hmm.
you know, or the low teens, you know, institutions became more reluctant to hire some of these individuals
mm-hmm.
because they're going to put in, to hire each individual, it usually costs the university somewhere on the order of $750,000 for an assistant professor, because you're getting them a starter package, you're covering their salaries for X number of years,
mm-hmm.
and it all adds up probably to somewhere between $750,000 to $750,000.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have somebody that is good but not great in a shaky funding environment, universities wouldn't hire them.
Mm-hmm.
If they had that same position, same funding environment, but an outstanding individual,
mm-hmm.
they would hire him, you know, mm-hmm. drop of a bat, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the opportunities have always been there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the number of really outstanding qualified individuals
mm-hmm.
haven't been there.
Mm-hmm.
But this is sort of the hierarchy that we built ourselves,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the top journals can only publish certain number of papers
right.
per month.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the reason why they are the ones that we, all of us, want to publish in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, outside of that, there really is nothing that's necessarily better about those particular places.
Right.
But as such, there are only a limited number of individuals that are going to have that mm-hmm. kind of quality paper.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, here at WashU, for the last 6 years that I've been here,
mm-hmm.
there have been multiple searches by multiple divisions, programs, and departments for a variety of positions of in immunology. And again, you know, there are lots of applicants.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the number of really outstanding qualified applicants, you know, in all the positions that have been availed over the last 6 years, I can probably count on two hands.
Really?
You know, to be able to point to somebody and say, this is a no-lose situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of applications are like, well, they've done okay.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that, you know,
mm-hmm.
makes you excited about hiring them? No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the individual comes and gives a seminar and they themselves aren't very enthusiastic about their own work,
yeah.
how can one be enthusiastic about their
right.
work?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's very hard to find the individual who's accomplished, who clearly shows the drive, shows the spark, who wants to have colleagues to collaborate with,
mm-hmm.
who's willing to contribute to part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And who is bright
mm-hmm.
and has a great system to work on
mm-hmm.
And looks like that they're going to be a winner. When you put all those factors together, you're talking about a handful of individuals
mm-hmm.
every year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the positions have been there. There are probably more positions now than there were before.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't, you know, always looks like we're hiring more. That's not necessarily true. Again, I think there may well be more positions, but I think what happens is that the bar becomes lower because
mm-hmm.
funding opportunities become better.
Mm-hmm.
So now the university says, well, this is still a risk, but it's not such a risk when we consider now the funding pay line is the 25th percentile.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you go from a pay line of 12.5% to 25%, that's not a difference of 12.5%. That's a 100% increase in the
mm-hmm.
percent of investigators that are going to be funded.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was such, you know, so devastating when they went from funding lines from the low 20th percentile to the low teens.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it wasn't 12 or 10% that were being cut off. Half the investigators are being
right.
cut off.
Right.
And actually, in those cycles for funding, for study sections, number of grants actually. mm-hmm. continued to dwindle for a number of years. Mm-hmm. To the point, remember, I remember sitting in study section and going, well, we have half the grants. Usually we take 2 days. After 1 day, we're going to be done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just because the number of people that are stayed in science had dwindled. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a combination of having the well-trained, and well-qualified mm-hmm. individual, mm-hmm. As well as having their own spark. Mm-hmm. And depending where the funding bar is, mm-hmm. increases or decreases the reluctance of a university to take certain risks. Sure. Yeah. I think it's that combination.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, since we've come to funding and grants, let's talk about that a little bit, because that's another, for most PIs, that's another huge chunk of what they do, mm-hmm. is either mm-hmm. chasing money or renewing money or mm-hmm. whatever. First of all, how are you supported here? Mm-hmm. Is your salary, does it come from grants, or do you have hard money for your salary?
So in the medical school, there's no such thing as hard money.
Okay.
Okay. Which means that we're expected all to bring in 100% of our salary, one way or the other.
Okay.
Now, I actually have been very fortunate because I'm a member of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Okay. So my salary is fully covered by the institute. But over the other, you know, other my colleagues, they're expected to bring 100% of their salary in the clinical departments based on grants. So whether it be in a, you know, they're all extramural grants, mm-hmm. Or American Cancer Society, mm-hmm. American Heart Association, mm-hmm. Arthritis Foundation, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. So those are the expectations. Mm-hmm. So to be able to cover close to 100% of one's salary, what that entails is probably getting funding from two R01 grants and one other non-NIH mm-hmm. Grant. Or part of a PPG or something like that. So that pretty much is a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the NIH has gone through huge swings over the past decade. Now is actually a great time. Uh-huh. 8 years ago wasn't such a good time.
Right. Now, tell me a little bit about the Howard Hughes, because I know that these institutes exist in various sites, various academic sites, mm-hmm. but how does it work exactly?
I mean, don't know.
You don't know. They just pay you, right?
So the institute itself has undergone some changes.
Okay.
So as of prior to 6 or 7 years ago, about 1993 and previously, the way the institutes work were that there were institutes at various medical centers. Because after all, Howard Hughes initially granted the money to be funded for medical sciences, and hence it began in medical schools. And each university would have X number of positions. They could nominate two, and upon approval would appoint those individuals to the institute positions. Mm-hmm. Over the past 6 to 7 years, that entire strategy has changed. So that now what happens is that when a certain number of positions open up, there is a call by the institute to all the universities, not all the universities, a selected number of universities. And I think it's based on the degree of NIH funding. And each one of them are given certain number of slots to nominate into. And then there's a national competition to ultimately select, again, X number of new investigators that will then go into the Hughes Institute. Mm-hmm. As a member of the Hughes Institute, depending on the level that you're at, you know, assistant professors or assistant investigators, associate investigators, and full professors, full investigators, you're given different levels of funding. Mm-hmm. But the salary of the investigator is fully covered by the institute. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, it is, you know, obviously a huge relief for one not to have to go and get the multiple R01s or the other mm-hmm. extramural sources mm-hmm. to get 100% of the funding. Mm-hmm.
Now, is this for a period of time or just
yeah.
indefinitely?
It is for a period of time. So assistant investigators now, as well as associate investigators, they go through you're appointed for a certain period of time. That typically is around a five-year period. Okay, so it's equivalent to what an NIH grant probably period is. Mm-hmm. And then you're subjected to review mm-hmm. After your review period mm-hmm. To determine whether you'll be your funding will be continued mm-hmm. At that level.
Okay. So was it the decision of WashU or was it the decision of Howard Hughes that you got that appointment?
It's both. So the institution has to nominate you.
Right.
So there is an internal competition for mm-hmm. The number of people that they would nominate. Mm-hmm. And then it would go to the Hughes Institute, and they have their own selection committee.
I see.
Now, when I joined the university in the Hughes Institute, I was right around the transition between the old rules and the new rules.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so at the time, I actually came in not through the national competition, but through just there was a position available within the institute, mm-hmm. And they submitted my name then to the national committee, who mm-hmm. then decided mm-hmm. based on you know whether I was qualified or not mm-hmm. for the position.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you conceivably stay in this institute for your whole career, or is there an exit time?
There is no particular limitation mm-hmm. on times that one can be an institute, one can remain with the mm-hmm. institute. It's based on the quality of work. Mm-hmm. Hence, the reviews become mm-hmm. extremely critical and obviously determining mm-hmm. whether one is permitted to stay within the mm-hmm. institute. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So given that you probably need one less R01 than everybody else to stay mm-hmm. afloat, how much of a commitment of your time is given over to trying to obtain or keep money?
Mm-hmm.
That is writing grants, schmoozing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, with the institute comes mm-hmm. certain expectations. Mm-hmm. These aren't written down anywhere, but the expectation mm-hmm. is that you have to be one of the leaders within the field. Okay. And the idea, I think, in part with the institute is that it allows one to spend less time on writing grants and more time thinking about the science. Mm-hmm. And that undoubtedly is true. Mm-hmm. Now, most Hughes investigators also hold R01 grants. Mm-hmm. Okay. But again, the expectations, I think, have become a little bit different. I hold as many R01 grants as probably a non-Hughes investigator would anyway. Okay? So right now, by certain strokes of fortune, in addition to my Hughes funding, I have three R01 grants.
Wow.
Okay? So, and it was just happened to be, a certain fluke in the timing of the grants that this came about. But because of that, there's a certain expectation that one does work mm-hmm. that's comparable to that particular level of funding.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the expectations always increase. The mm-hmm. bar always gets raised mm-hmm. With everything. And that's mm-hmm. always true about science. You know, whatever you do or what you did technically has to be more advanced the next time around.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're not going to get your paper published in the same high-quality type of journal.
Mm-hmm. Let me change the tape.